So Christina Gallego will be presenting on the language situation in Philippine minority language communities. It is not, as it was erroneously reported in the program about diabetes, that was a better talk story. So this is the situation in the Philippines, and she has people to help her with question and answer. It'll be 20 minutes for the presentation and 10 minutes for question and answer.
So thank you very much for coming. I know it's the last session for today, so really appreciate you staying for our presentation. So I'll be talking about the language situation in the Philippines, and let me start by giving a brief background on the linguistic situation of the Philippines. And I'm sure that we are all aware of the difficulty in counting languages, as various factors come into play in doing such endeavor. In the Philippines, the number of languages vary depending on who's counting. The number ranges from about 80 languages to 186, according to Ethnologue 2015. Now, looking at the variety of the Philippine languages based on the recent Ethnologue report, we can see that the Philippines isn't doing so bad, with 41 institutional and 72 developing languages. However, there is a need to revisit the data and conduct a more rigorous field work in the communities to accurately assess the status and vitality of these languages. Blust 1991, based on previous studies on the subgrouping of Philippine languages, proposes 9 microgroups for the Philippines. Originally 15 microgroups, Blust proposes that the languages of Central Philippines form a unitary group he calls the Greater Central Philippine Microgroup. So for our team at the University of the Philippines is working on the relationship of the Greater Central Philippine languages using quantitative methods. So this pattern of inheritance using phylogenetic trees formed from quantitative methods are in wide use in biology, and applications of such methods to language families have recently been attempted, but none have been fully accepted by the historical linguistics community due to the use of faulty secondhand data and simplistic metrics. Our study aims to generate a phylogenetic tree of Philippine languages with distances computed between words and languages based on a modification of Hamming and Levenshtein distance. So this research is actually a collaborative work between the Department of Linguistics, our department, and the Institute of Mathematics at the University of the Philippines, Diliman. It consists of 2 projects, one on data gathering and post-processing, and another on analysis and the construction of phylogenetic tree and network. So this research primarily aims to collect and process firsthand linguistic data to be able to generate a more accurate phylogenetic tree and network of languages in Greater Central Philippines based on a modified word list. Specifically, this project aims to generate the following outputs. So as mentioned, the first part of the project involves field work in various areas of the Philippines. As of 2016, we have done field work in 5 areas excluding Manila, and these are Mindoro, Iloilo, Palawan, Davao, and Zamboanga. In the course of collecting lexical data from over 50 Philippine languages around the country for our research project, we have also seen the linguistic situation in the different ethno-linguistic communities, their attitudes towards implemented language policies, and their opinions about projects that promote or would promote the maintenance or revitalization of minority languages in the country. So for this presentation, we will be focusing on 3 ethno-linguistic groups, the Tagbanwas of Palawan, the Hanunoos of Mindoro, and the Mansakas of Mindanao. The 3 groups have undergone different experiences, and thus they tell different stories, some a little more bleak than the others, but all 3 provide interesting insights regarding the future of Philippine languages vis-a-vis existing language policies and socio-economic forces. So first, the Tagbanwas. While a single name is used to refer to this group, there are actually 3 different Tagbanwa groups in Palawan with relatively low mutual intelligibility with each other. These are the Kalamian, Central, and Aborlan Tagbanwa. Kalamian Tagbanwa is spoken in Coron and is described as a developing language according to Ethnologue. As of 2007, the language is reported to have 10,000 speakers. And this variety of Tagbanwa is not considered a Central Philippine language. For Central Tagbanwa, it is spoken in the northern part of Palawan, and it is nearly extinct, according to Ethnologue, and has about 2,000 speakers as of 1985. So that's the most recent data. And finally, for Aborlan Tagbanwa, it is mainly spoken in Puerto Princesa and classified as a developing language. It has about 10,000 speakers as of 2002. So in our field research in Puerto Princesa, it became apparent to us that mothers play a central role in passing on the language, since it is usually the mothers who decide which language to use at home. Pictured here are three generations of Tagbanwa speakers: Rosemarie, the youngest one, and Rosaline, her mother, and Nieves, her grandmother. So Ethnologue notes that Tagbanwa is met with negative attitudes among its speakers. Tagbanwa speakers are somewhat ashamed to be identified as Tagbanwa and choose to speak Filipino or Kuyunon as they can. The Tagbanwa children get bullied in school because of ethnicity, and that members of smaller ethno-linguistic groups tend to be labeled as primitive and uncivilized and are usually seen as slow learners. So it is not surprising then that they choose to abandon their first language in favor of more prestigious ones to avoid such labels. The negative attitude towards Tagbanwa is only one factor that contributed to the decline in the use of the language. The immigration of Tagalog speakers in Palawan led to the changes in the linguistic landscape of the island. Tagalog speakers now comprise more than half of the province's 1.1 million population, and has now replaced Kuyunon as the province's lingua franca. As growing number of Palawan speakers, as well as speakers of other languages indigenous to the province, are now fluent in Tagalog, primarily due to the use of the latter as the medium of instruction in schools and the primary language of media. So state-initiated programs, such as the establishment of the leper and penal colony, display smaller groups such as the Tagbanwas, which then push them to the peripheries. So at present, private corporations contribute to this ongoing displacement of the Palawan groups. So they buy land from the locals for a cheap price and resell them. So this sign shows a subdivision, lots for sale. Okay. So next is Hanunoo. So Hanunoo is a Mangyan language spoken in Mindoro. In the island, there are 8 recognized ethno-linguistic groups. So one of them is Hanunoo. It is, again, spoken in Mindoro, classified as a developing language. It has about 13,000 speakers. So Panaytayan is a Hanunoo community in Oriental Mindoro. So it is 12 hours from Manila by bus, and then ferry, and then motorcycle. So two of our language consultants are teachers of Panaytayan Elementary School. According to them, the language is still being passed on to children, and children are more comfortable using Hanunoo as the medium of learning, at least in Panaytayan. While Filipino is still the medium of instruction in Panaytayan, the teachers actually use Hanunoo to explain more difficult concepts, and they say that the students find it easier to understand the lessons in Hanunoo. While there is a need to document the language and culture of different ethno-linguistic groups, a lot of times the community would feel used to a certain extent that they often feel left out or alienated from the research that we're doing. Bapa, or an uncle, asked us about what we were doing in the community, and we had to explain our project to him. So we wanted to assure him that we would credit him for our research. And he was telling us that a lot of researchers have come to the community claiming to do research on a particular aspect of the Hanunoo culture, but without actually giving them proper credit or acknowledgement. And the Hanunoo is perhaps one of the most documented Mangyan groups, which is also the very reason why the Hanunoos feel wary of researchers. The most famous one and the beloved figure in the community was Anton Postma, an anthropologist who worked on the description of the culture of the Mangyan. It was thanks to Anton Postma that Hanunoo became widely recognized. So he documented 20,000 Ambahan or Mangyan poems. And Hanunoos fondly call him Bapa or Uncle as a sign of respect. And according to one of the speakers, if not for him, I would not know how rich our culture is. Bapa Postma passed away just last October 2016. And despite this empowerment, the dynamics between those in the center and the periphery still exist. The Hanunoos, along with other Mangyan groups, still have not fully escaped issues of racism and bullying, just like the Tagbanuas. So even within the Mangyan groups, the issue of othering is very much prevalent. Hanunoo, because of the presence of Anton Posma, is considered the most prestigious or pure, given its while Bangon, given its isolation from the other Mangyan groups, are seen as less civilized. So despite the efforts of people like Anton Postma, we always find ourselves going back to the game of us versus them. And finally, for Mansaka, it's spoken in Mindanao, specifically in Compostela Bay. It is considered a developing language with 57,800 speakers. So perhaps because we talked with Mansakas who were part of the local government, one is a chief holding office in Tagum City Tribal and Muslim Affairs Department, and the other is a bailan or a shaman. We got the impression that they are very proud of their culture and has a lot more influence over the governance of their group. So a lot of them go around their everyday activities wearing some traditional piece of clothing like headdress for men and beaded necklaces and bracelets. And they also regularly hold culture classes. So the Mansaka language is still going strong. They seem to have a strong and well-organized leadership system who are motivated to keep their culture alive. So these are some of the Kaagan speakers who, Kaagan is related to Mansaka. So deriving from the three case studies I discussed, I will now highlight in this section some of the factors that contribute to the status of Philippine languages. So first is the shifting economic practices of the people. So at present, groups from small communities, such as the Mangyan, usually go down to trade with the lowlanders. So they plant and harvest crops and transport them downtown. So this one is done by floating produce using rubber tubes. Because of continuing contact with lowlanders, a lot of the members prefer to stay in the city, mostly for economic and practical reasons. Some of them go to school in the city or work as a house help. But you can also see that there is another reaction to this. So I will quote one passage. It was told to us that this community was under a curse that was leading to people getting sick and crops not growing good produce. An old shaman told his people that if they continue to settle into communities and move away from their mountain homes, they would have this curse put upon them. While a great number of them still follow such indigenous practices and beliefs, a lot of them still choose to leave as the benefits of living in the lowland outweighs staying in their home communities. Also, the issue of resettlement and displacement also contributes to the decline of smaller languages, like what I discussed in the case of the Tagbanuas. And some of them are actually state-sponsored. Also, natural disasters such as earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, as well as typhoons pose risks to the ethno-linguistic groups. Perhaps one of the worst was what happened to the Aita communities during the eruption of Mount Pinatubo. So the Aita communities got displaced, they got mixed with other Aita groups, totally unrelated to them, so they had to shift languages. Also, large-scale mining has also drastically affected the landscape of the groups. This one, the town of Mainit in Compostela Valley, a community of Mansakan speakers, was a primary dumping ground for cyanide waste from a mining company. Also, the problem is mining problem is related to the continuing militarization in Mindanao. So based on, because of a lot of communities have been affected by these mining corporations, Lumad communities have protested against mining operations done in their ancestral domain. Mining and militarization go hand in hand. Some leaders of the communities who protested against mining were brutally murdered by alleged members of the military. Connected to this is the presence of rebel groups such as the New People's Army. This one is based in Mindanao. So pro-military personalities have accused Lumad communities of comprising the majority of NPA fighters in Mindanao. Moreover, those who do not affiliate with either NPA or the military are often caught in the crossfire. So they are often the ones who suffer collateral damage. Ethnocide and linguicide contribute to the endangerment of smaller languages. And not only that, we also see the decline in the use of these languages going hand in hand with the rise of the regional lingua francas. A lot of speakers choose to shift to the bigger languages in the region, largely for economic and practical purposes. They also do it, like I mentioned, to escape prejudice and racism. This has then contributed to the rise in moribund languages in the Philippines. Some cases of language shift are actually perhaps an unintended consequence of some language policies implemented in the last few decades, like the declaration of Tagalog-based Filipino as the national language of the Philippines. So on the one hand, declaring a national language is argued to promote nationalism, but some people, on the other hand, would argue that that favoring one language over the rest of the Philippine languages defeats the purpose of declaring a national language. Moreover, it seems that regionalistic pride still prevails over nationalistic aspirations. And finally, another unintended consequence of this is the endangerment of smaller languages of the country. Also, the bilingual education policy, which started in 1974, making use of English and Filipino, is an example of linguicide. Students would be forced to pay fine, like 1 peso per word, if ever they speak their mother tongue. And to address issues in school effectiveness for language minority students, the policy of using the mother tongue as medium of instruction has been implemented just a few years ago. Fundamentally, the policy aims to start learning from where the students are. However, given the linguistic situation of the Philippines, such policy is a logistical nightmare. Some communities are highly multilingual, so there are different languages spoken in just one community. So the schools have resorted to using the regional lingua franca as a medium of instruction. But in some cases, the students are not really learning in their mother tongue, but in a language totally alien to them. So the local languages are then pushed further to the fringes of society. Finally, for the IP education, this one is pursued through sustainable community engagement. So making use of indigenous knowledge systems and practices and indigenous learning systems in the basic education curriculum. From what we have gathered, we saw a lot of support for this program. But perhaps an issue is the establishment of IP schools exclusive to IPs. So schools are exclusive to indigenous people. On the one hand, cases of bullying will definitely be addressed and lessened. But on the other hand, it seems that this is a band-aid solution that might even widen the gap between IPs and non-IPs. That perhaps it does not really help them to be fully integrated in the national discourse. Whether or not this policy works is something we cannot answer at the moment, but it's definitely something that is worth following. Not only national language policies have an effect on IP communities, but research projects as well. A lot of times we saw how the locals have become wary and fatigued of researchers because of their experiences in the past. Thus, we saw varying levels of enthusiasm towards different research projects. However, researchers working with communities regarding revitalization projects are met with great support, such as POSTMAS project on revitalizing Surat Mangyan or the use of Mangyan syllabary in schools. Recently, the elders of the Isanay community in Northern Philippines have made an effort to document and revitalize their own language, and they themselves sought contact with linguists such as Lawrence Reed to help in the documentation of their language. So as a conclusion, we saw that there are several factors at play in the vitality of the languages of the Philippines. And a lot of times, endangerment happens because of the attitude of the speakers, not only towards other languages, but towards their own language as well. So the Philippine government needs to address issues that contribute to the continuing marginalization of smaller ethno-linguistic groups, such as the issues of mining, militarization, and even language policies. So there is a need to have a general adjustment from the Filipinos, both the common people and the administrators, regarding attitudes towards languages and the different ethno-linguistic groups from the country. Furthermore, research projects from the academe should always seek community engagement and ultimately aim to give back to the communities to address the issue of research fatigue. So the Philippines still has a long way to go regarding the documentation and revitalization of its minority languages. But a good thing to note is that the local media has now become aware of issues surrounding these languages, particularly regarding endangerment and extinction. Thus, communities are now becoming aware that such issues are important as well, and they themselves are starting to make an effort in revitalizing their own languages. So that's it. So this is the linguistics team of the phylogeny project.
Yes, so I was wondering whether you can tell something about the influence of the recent abrupt change in government on the situation of the languages, in particular, since you mentioned mining. There's a lot of the mines have been closed down by Gina Lopez recently, and there's lots of peace talks between the government and several other militant groups, perhaps excluding Abu Sayyaf. And then also about the, you know, with respect to the government's move towards a federalist kind of nation, right?
With regards to the current administration in the Philippines, there are some communities that prefer this current administration because there's a shift in the focus of language rather than former administrators focusing on Tagalog and Filipino as a national lingua franca. The current president speaks another mother tongue, so, and usually he speaks using that language in several of his speeches and blah, 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 blah. So communities who also share that particular language feel more involved regarding everything that he does. But about the changes, for example, in mining, what is played in the media is quite different from what is seen in the field, because, for example, in the media, it shows that everything has been, all the mining activities have been shut down. But when you go to the field, actually the issue is not the legal mining activities, more of the illegal mining activities, because the legal mining activities, you always go through the normal processes, the paperwork, but the illegal mining are still there, whether you want them to be there or you want them not to be there. So even if you close the big legal companies, the plethora of illegal mining companies are still there. So illegal or legal doesn't change the landscape. There's still mining in the area. So the indigenous communities are still affected.
With respect to the militant groups?
Actually, the peace talks are now canceled.
Yeah, because initially during the change in the administration, there's like a ceasefire because they want to address all the issues, and then they had the falling out, so
yeah,
they canceled the ceasefire, and then everything just resumed just the way it was before.
With the MPA?
Yes.
With the MPA.
Yeah, with the MPA.
So at present, it's not a really stable thing in the Philippines. We don't know what will happen next.
Who's the current secretary of the Philippines?
Leonor Briones.
Okay,
yes,
that's what I
don't know
him. Her.
Her,
sorry. I don't know her. Does she have agenda on language revitalization?
None that we know.
Though the current Department of Education has a project, because the Philippines recently shifted the educational policy to a K-12, so
okay,
we have a 12-year basic education now, similar to other ASEAN countries, from a 10-year education system. So because of the transition period from a 10-year to a 12-year, we have a gap of student generation. So using that transition period, they want to mobilize all the displaced teachers, language-related, social science-related, to do language documentation in the Philippines, so they have that particular program.
Yeah.
But besides that, I don't know any other projects from the language documentation?
There are clamors to cancel the K-12. Yes, but I think the government is bent on continuing as well as the mother tongue-based multilingual education. The problem about MTBMLE is mainly logistics, like what Inas mentioned earlier. You would find communities trying to teach the language in their area, but there are no resources available. So the teachers would end up just, you know, making their own, trying to improvise materials that they could use for teaching.
Some of the materials they get are actually from a related language or a related dialect, but
yes,
still different and unintelligible for the students. Like the one in Bicol, they get Bicol Naga, but then they speak another variety. So what happened is they went back to Filipino, went back to using Filipino as the.
And multilingual classrooms are a huge problem because you find a lot of classrooms with pupils speaking different mother tongues. What the teacher would decide probably on using either the lingua franca in the region or Tagalog.
So does that mean that we are going back to the bilingual education?
Actually, we call it now trilingual.
Oh, okay.
Because
okay,
before it was bilingual, Filipino and Tagalog. Then it was changed to a mother tongue-based multilingual education, which initially was planned to have mother tongue for all the basic grades. So you have full mother tongue immersion for grade 1 to, initially for grade 1 to 6, but it was just planned for grade 1 to 3. But because there are some factions from the ultra-nationalists and from the English-only faction, they didn't accept mother tongue immersion for the basic grades. So even now, the current implementation of mother tongue, you have English courses for the grade 1. You also have Filipino classes for the grade 1.
Yes.
When the mother tongue education insists that you should use the mother tongue for the first several grades, that's why we're using supposedly mother tongue education. But as we have said, there are so many programs that are theoretically sound, but the problem is on how they are implemented in the country.
Other questions?
You mentioned earlier in your talk that I think there were three languages, and you said that they're partially mutually intelligible or something to that effect. You didn't say that?
Mutually unintelligible.
Partially mutually unintelligible or totally mutual? I thought the word was partially.
Parts.
Yeah, so I was just wondering how that was determined.
I just based actually that on the data from Ethnologue.
And how did they determine
it? So they conduct fieldwork too. I think they do lexical comparisons as well, the ESIL, Summer Institute of Linguistics.
So they actually, Bill's telling me they did some type of intelligibility survey. I just was curious as to
I
what it would look
that.
Like since I do them myself.
Actually wanting to do, like to gather new data. The problem is among the Tagbanua groups, one of them, the central Tagbanua, is nearly extinct. So the last time I went to Palawan for fieldwork, I couldn't find a speaker anymore for this particular variety of Tagbanua. So if you have followed the history of these groups in Palawan, the original inhabitants of the province are only three ethnolinguistic groups. Long time ago, the Tagbanuas, Palawan, and the Batak. And because the area where they could actually live is so big, so eventually Tagbanuas split into three varieties, also Palawan split into three varieties, and Batak was just the one that actually remained in the central area. And the divergence went to the point of splitting completely into becoming different languages. But now, because of these problems, these ethnolinguistic groups are forced to move into small compact communities on top of the mountains of Palau. Do you have any other questions?
Time for one more question?
Mine
mine is kind of unrelated to this. I was just drawn to this phylogenetic project. Like you mentioned in early on that you have collected word lists. I was wondering how long of the word lists were, and also you said that there was mathematics department who was doing that. So I was wondering how do and to do the cognate set. Like, do you have a linguist or a machine?
So we have a 500 word list.
Mm-hmm.
505 word list that was devised by the department so that it accommodates more lexemes appropriate for the Philippine languages.
Yeah.
Because we currently have the Austronesian Swadesh list, but there are still terms in the Austronesian Swadesh list that's applicable for Philippine languages. So the department has devised one word list, and then. For the first part, with regards to determination of cognates, it is the linguist in the team who determines cognates because it's, the machine can do cognacy tests. So initially, the after the data has been collected, the linguist will determine and remove all the borrowings, identify the cognates, determine which belongs to which sets, and then after all the tabulation and analysis, then you enter those data to the machine, and then the machine do the distance analysis.
Right. So do you have a specific program for
that? The mathematics department devised their own program, but they use several types of methods. So they have like maximal parsimony, they have Bayesian, they have the normal unweighted leverage time, and then the weighted leverage time, and then some other math.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah.
So a role in the project is the first 1.5 years. So our main tasks mainly we gather data and determine the cognates, and then the next 1.5 years for the math department to do the computation.
Yeah, we're nearly finished with our part, so the next step is the math part.
Excellent. So in the next
we're still missing a few languages. Unfortunately, we're not. I think we somehow like missed on the fact that some languages may really be hard to find in terms of native speakers. So there are some languages we determined to be in the list initially, but suddenly when we went to the field to find them, we couldn't find one.
Well, thank you very much. That was very.